I have in my possession something that has been seen by a few of us here in this hall before. It is something that I've used a time or two in my shop in our basement. Prior to my having it, my grandfather had this square. It's a rosewood square. It was fairly common in its day. It has a very functional hole drilled through the rosewood handle. It has across the ruler side a distinct rust patina that has gone through to the point where there are no legible hash marks, no numbers visible. What used to be a full-length ruler now has, I'm not sure if you can see it or not, but it is no longer a right angle across the top, which says to me that at some point or another, it may have been used as a screwdriver. It may have been used as a paint can prying device. It's been used. It's been used for its intended purpose. And it was, quite honestly, despite the condition it's in, it was an honor to receive it from Grandpa's shop. And now it sits in my shop, and I get to use it for various projects. And my sons have used it for various projects. And they are maybe wondering at some point which of them will get to inherit it, as I myself have inherited this particular square. I'll refer to it later on. Many of us have received certain doodads, knickknacks, tools from other generations, and we receive it, we inherit it, and get to utilize it. Maybe it just sits on a shelf, but in any event, it's a real privilege to inherit something. And we all, as Christians, have opportunity to inherit. We have opportunity to provide inheritance to others. And what I'd like to do today is to speak on that subject, because it is a Christian responsibility to provide an inheritance and also to receive an inheritance. I'd like to speak about those elements that we all engage in. One such inheritance that we can discuss, we can turn to Proverbs chapter 13, if you'd follow me, please, to the book of Proverbs. And together we'll read Proverbs 13. Verse 22. Proverbs 13, verse 22. And here in this proverb we read, "A good man leaves an inheritance." It's nice to gather things, but it says here, "A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children." And that was the case of this particular square. It kind of missed a generation and went to me, not to mom first. "But a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, but the wealth of the sinner is stored up for the righteous." It is a pleasure to be able to leave an inheritance. We see wealth alluded to here in this particular passage, but it's not exclusive to just wealth. It is important in the context of pondering our mortality. What am I going to leave behind? What am I going to pass on to the next generation? And in so doing, we can't help but ponder, well, it's not just about me. It's nice to have things, but what am I going to do with this stuff? And society struggles with not me. Society is very much in the mindset of me. It's about me first. I was there first. Just take the last couple of weeks. How easy was it to get to the checkout line? How easy was it to get into a shopping mall, a shopping plaza, or to get out? Individuals were very focused on their own individual needs. There was a comedian once upon a time who made this observation, not specifically about a season, but society in general, were thinking about different magazines. We go to a checkout line and we see the magazines asking for us to buy them at inflated prices. And you see the title of them in a popular magazine, maybe still is, but was People Magazine, a magazine about other people. And another magazine became popular, maybe more popular, called Us. Not just about people, no, it's about us. It's more restrictive. And then there's another magazine called We, which you could argue is the same as us, but We is more restrictive. Not just about us, it's about we. It's a subset of us, and that's a subset of people. And this comedian was talking, well, isn't it interesting? Some point, somebody is going to make the magazine called Me. And you open the cover, it's polished, mylar, it's reflective, and you just see a reflection of yourself. It's going to be a beautiful magazine about me. Back to Proverbs 13:22. The wealth of the sinner is stored up for the righteous. And again, this can be talking about monetary wealth. There is an individual in one of our home congregations who looks at families and sees when they're getting along well, sees that they have good connectivity between generations, and said, they're a rich family. And they may not have a lot, but they're a rich family. They have wealth in the relationships that they have. This particular proverb that we're looking at doesn't imply that wealth is somehow correlated with righteousness, but makes a general observation how God in the long run will see to this particular fact. While still recognizing, we see other scriptures talk about fiscal hardships, even of righteous people. Let's take a look at Mark chapter 12. Mark chapter 12. And here, starting in verse 41, we read the last portion of this particular chapter of the book of Mark. Now, Jesus sat opposite the treasury and saw how the people put money into the treasury. He was watching. God is interested in a variety of things in our life. He's interested in what we do. He's also interested in finding out why we do what we're doing. And he was noting that here in this particular case. He was watching people put money into the treasury, and many who were rich put in much. I can remember being 10 or 11 at the Feast of Tabernacles, taking money out of the bank, and there was a certain amount. I can't remember what it was, but I do remember asking the teller, give it to me in ones. And counting one at a time. So I'd have a stack of bills. And that was going to be some, look how much money I have. And probably half of it went to video games at the time. But having that stack of bills, when he saw the rich putting in much, were they putting in just a single coin, or did they put it in once so they could stand there a while and let it clink in and prolong the amount of time that they were in front of the treasury? We don't know for sure, but I can't help but wonder. Verse 42, then one poor widow came and threw in two mites, two small copper coins, which makes a quadrants. And he called his disciples to himself and said to them, assuredly, I say to you, he's telling them a truism. This is truer than true. He says, this poor widow has put in more than all those who've given to the treasury. And they may have heard this. They likely would have seen what had transpired before and witnessed the spectacle themselves and were wondering, how is this so? How did this poor widow, who put in only two coins and maybe it didn't even clink, you can tell a real silver coin when it is spun on a table, when it falls, it has a ring to it. You can tell that's real money compared to the copper coins that we call pennies now. And they fall, and they don't sound the same. There's no ring, and surely they would have heard a couple of clacks as these coins went in. For they all put in out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, put in all that she had, her whole livelihood. And we don't have the backstory. We don't know, was she living with family and she was doing other work and that other work paid little. And from that work she put into the treasury while still having her needs taken care of. We don't quite know all the details, but Jesus Christ saw the contrast between how much these other wealthy individuals had, and they put in some out of their abundance, which seemed like a lot, but considering what they had wasn't much, contrasting to what this widow endured to earn those two mites, and she willingly gave that in the treasury. Jesus Christ didn't look down on this poor widow, despite her meager means. In fact, he highlighted her to his disciples and to all of us. We're still hearing about her remarkable example. So it wasn't poverty that he looked down on. He saw this remarkable righteousness that she had that wasn't correlated with fiscal wealth. That's important for us to consider in thinking about inheritance. And yet, still, Proverbs does talk about a good man leaves an inheritance for his children's children. Ecclesiastes chapter 9. Let's turn there next. Ecclesiastes chapter 9. And here in chapter 9 of Ecclesiastes, let's start in verse 11. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 11. I returned and I saw under the sun. This was a universal observation that the preacher is making here and sharing with us. The race is not always to the swift, nor the battle again, always to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. And sometimes time and chance can be positive. Time and chance can have negative context as well. Individuals can stumble on something remarkable. Individuals can stumble on something awful. Time and chance happen on both sides of that equation. I can remember working hard on studying for a test, and while I was filling out my, it must have been one of those Scantron sheets, because I was circling and double checking, making sure I wasn't straying out of the line. Did I use an HB or an HP, or was it a 2H? What kind of pencil? But that mattered, right? Filling in those bubbles and looking over, and the guy next to me was looking and copying my answers. And he wasn't particularly nice to me. So seeing that, I started answering the wrong ones, waited till he was done, and I just erased mine and went back and filled in the right ones. He wasn't very happy with me for that. Sometimes the slacker gets a good mark. Sometimes the blind squirrel gets the nut, right? It does happen. Sometimes the lazy people at work, they get the promotions. And sometimes the hardworking person faces an inordinate amount of hardship, difficulties. Ecclesiastes 9:11 speaks to that. Good things are not exclusive experiences for good people in this life. And inconveniences, hardships, trials, even tragedies are not always falling on bad people. That does often fall on righteous people. You can read the book of Job for consolation in this particular regard. So when we think about inheritance, yes, Proverbs speaks about a good man leaving an inheritance to his children's children, but sometimes bad things happen. Sometimes inconveniences fall. Sometimes it really hits a family hard. And let's take a look at Leviticus 25. Leviticus 25. Let's read Leviticus 25, verse 23. Leviticus 25, verse 23, the land shall not be sold permanently. Why? For the land is mine. Is this still the case? Does the earth still belong to God? It's still his, isn't it? and we have this idea that we buy land. Once upon a time, I was tremendously excited to move back to the States. It was a place, Grandpa's farm, was like a common location, regardless of where my family lived, in Eastern Canada or Western Canada. The farm in Missouri was home. It felt home to me. So when we moved to Ohio, my wife and I, in 2000, it was a joy to me, thinking I'm closer to home. And maybe someday I'll have some of Grandpa's farm and live there, and I can have my own chickens. I always wanted to have chickens. My wife got us some chickens one time, and I did have that goal partly satiated of having chickens. My favorite thing to do in a Sabbath morning was to drink coffee and watch the chickens chicken and see them, their antics, and I just enjoyed that. The land is mine, God said. You are strangers and sojourners with me, and in all the land of your possession you shall grant redemption of the land. If one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possessions, and if his redeeming relative comes to redeem it, then he may redeem what his brother sold. Or if the man has no one to redeem it, but he himself becomes able to redeem it, then let him count the years since its sale, and restore the remainder to the man to whom he sold it, that he may return to his possession. This element that God has is people need a home. Families need a home. Clans need a home for where they can return. But if he's not able to have it restored to him, then what was sold shall remain in the hand of him who bought it until the year of Jubilee. And in the Jubilee it shall be released, and he shall return to his possession. This civil contract that God made with Israel, that he made them make to each other, was to allow for fiscal hardships, to allow for land that had been allotted to a family to be temporarily out of their hands, but to be restored here at this year of Jubilee on the Day of Atonement. There are any number of people who, or families who have incurred loss of the family farm. And that happened to my family too. Grandpa gave it to an uncle. My uncle had it for many years and got sick. He got sick and was dead within a matter of weeks. And the family farm went up for sheriff's auction, and now someone else lives there. I'm glad one of my cousins was able to carve out a section of it many years before, and still, he's there, and every time I go to visit him, I can still feel a connection to home. It still feels home. It's a weird thing, but it's true. This precept, this regulation, ensured that people would have access to their roots, to have access to their home, even if only after the year of Jubilee, they would still have connection to their ancestral lands. And what a difference that can make. What a difference that can make for even just the mental concept of how much work do I want to put into this land? There's a nice spring here. Do I want to make a cistern here? Do I want to wall it off? What do I want to do with this land? Because I'm going to be here, and then my children will be here, my children's children will be here. It would have to change the mindset of what am I willing to do to this land? Now we think, how much time's left on the mortgage? And what are the kids? The kids aren't going to want to be here. I can tell they want to be there, or this one wants to be there. We have a very different mentality now. But this idea that God had, this regulation that God had, was for land to be inherited, for home to be inherited, for place to be inherited. Is that all that we can inherit? Is there more that we do inherit consciously, subconsciously? Let's turn to the book of Judges. Judges chapter 12. We're going to break into a story starting in verse 5 of Judges 12. It's not a happy story, but there's a point to it. Judges 12, verse 5, the Gileadites seized the fords of the Jordan before the Ephraimites arrived, there was another civil squabble, civil war, even at a smaller scale that's occurring at this point. And when any Ephraimite who escaped said, "Let me cross over," the men of Gilead would say to him, excuse me, "Are you an Ephraimite?" And if he said, "No," then they would say to him, "Then say Shibboleth." And he would say Sibboleth, for he could not pronounce it right. They would take him and kill him at the fords of the Jordan. They fell at that time 42,000 Ephraimites. One of the things we do inherit are accents. We inherit accents. We don't sign up for them. They're just kind of given to us, and we take them without knowing we've taken them until we travel, and then someone says, "You talk funny. What do you mean? You have an accent." And we say, "No, you have an accent." And we get into an argument about who's saying Wisconsin right, who knows how to say Toronto versus Toronto. These accents are easy to not think of until we do travel. I know when we moved to Ohio, I would think for a while before I would say certain words, about instead of about. We're known in Canada of saying about funny. None of us think we do, but we travel and we find out we do. Even different words mean different things where we go. The first winter we were in Ohio, we laughed. People here, I'm sure, wear knitted hats in the wintertime. What do we call them here? Just a hat? A knit hat? Some people might call what, beanies? Okay, in Ohio, we couldn't believe it when we were getting ready to go outside and someone said, "Would you like to wear a toboggan?" That was our response. For us, where normal people speak, a toboggan is a sled that you ride down in the snow. Yeah, and in Ohio, where we were, that was what knit hats were called, toboggans. We don't even think about it, but we inherit vocabulary, we inherit accents, we inherit even how we speak. There's a modality that is unique even to families. And as we are called, we sometimes recognize, ooh, that way or that mode is maybe too negative, too cutting, too critical. And we have to change. We work hard to change. We work hard sometimes to lose our accents. We'll work hard to fit in, to blend in. And we also recognize that language that I got so accustomed to on the job site, that's not acceptable in God's eyes. I need to unlearn some of these things, and it takes time, takes God's Spirit for that de-education and re-education for how we should speak in those areas that are deep-seated, inherited speech. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 12. Matthew chapter 12 next, and read Matthew's account, starting in verse 46 of Matthew chapter 12. Matthew 12, verse 46 reads, "While he was still talking to the multitudes, behold, his mother and brothers stood outside seeking to speak with him." They were outside. Were they late? Why were they outside? Was it too crowded? They couldn't fit in? They were outside. "And one said to him, 'Look, your mother and your brothers, they're out standing outside seeking to speak with you.'" Which I find interesting. Somehow there was the ability to get word into this building, but they couldn't bring themselves to come in themselves. They sent word. "We don't want to be seen in there." Maybe was that part of it? Time will tell. "He answered and said to the one who told him, he said to them, 'Who is my mother? Who are my brothers?' Stretched out his hand towards his disciples, and he said, 'Here are my brother and my mother. Sorry, my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother.'" I wonder, what did family think, the blood family think, when they heard this? I can't imagine he whispered this. I can't help but wonder, they overheard this, and what was their reaction? Well, if that's the way he's going to think of us, if that's the way he's going to talk about us. There's a lot to chew on in this particular passage. It's a nice thing to travel, to go to a feast site, to travel across the country. We go to another Church of God, and we find family. We find our brothers and sisters, no matter where we go, having the same spirit. In this particular case, we see an axiom to consider when there is conflict between our physical family and our spiritual family. We can have some difficult choices to make. And Jesus Christ, taking the long view, said, here are my brothers, my sisters, my mother. This is my family. They're doing God's will. There's a further element for us to consider in this inheritance of brothers and sisters. When we think about those who share our faith, whether it's the broader possible Christian label, or if we narrow it down to the Church of God label, narrowing it even further to the United Church of God label, what do we leave in terms of inheritance for our faith? In watching, whether it's entertainment or news, anytime a Christian is featured, are they typically featured in a positive light? Or are they quick to try to focus in on something that's odd or off balance? Rarely is there any presentation of any laudable characteristics. Now, these Christians, they're rigid, they're backward thinking. How do we present ourselves? How do we conduct ourselves? And those who learn that we're Christian, do they say, oh, okay, that makes sense? Or do they say, really? Hopefully we are conducting ourselves in such a way that we're leaving a good impression, which is important for us whether we're Christians or not. Let's take a look at Proverbs 22 again. Let's go back to the book of Proverbs. And let's read the first verse here of Proverbs 22. Proverbs 22, verse 1. A good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, and loving favor rather than silver and gold. A good name is to be chosen. All throughout elementary school and high school, I've dreaded that first week back. Not just because I had to go to school again, but there was that awkward moment where everybody had to introduce themselves. My name is John Smith. My name is Sally Jones. And I had to wait for the entire class to finish before I said, my name's Paul Wasselkoff. Everybody turns their head around. What kind of weird name is that? Like they'd never heard the name Paul before, I guess. But then helping the teachers, W-A-S-I-L-K-O-F-F, and I just didn't want the attention, and I just knew as soon as I said my name, I was going to have to explain a few things. But I got to appreciate the good name that Dad had made over the years, and meeting some of his colleagues when we moved to the USA, and interfacing with some of the ones who went to school with him, I appreciated his good name. A good name is to be chosen rather than great riches. And we don't choose our name, do we? It's just handed to us. And I never appreciated the amount of time and agonizing that a parent goes through selecting a name until it was our turn, my wife and I, to name three boys. And to come up with names that would work, that was reflective a little bit of them, that was not going to be an automatic playground black hole of taunts and teasing. Names that they could appreciate. How many hours did we spend going through books, book after book, page after page? I like this one. This is a good comment. No, that reminds me of some mean person in school. We can't use that name. They were a real nasty one. But a good name is to be chosen rather than riches. We don't choose our names. But what can we choose? Well, we choose the name that becomes associated with our name. And again, whether it's our family name, or our Christian name, or our Sabbatarian name, or Church of God name, or United Church of God name, what are we choosing? How are we cultivating that name? When my grandfather died, it was interesting to hear different individuals talk about him. He'd been in that community all his life. I think he was born, had his own farm, retired, and died all within probably about 3 miles, 3 mile radius. It was a remarkably short journey considering he had gone over to Europe in the 40s with so many others. That as individuals would come by, I overheard a conversation and they said, you know, I've never heard a bad name, a bad thing said about this family, about the Esslinger family. And that really twigged with me and thought, okay, if anybody is ever in Ozark County, Missouri, and you ever have any car trouble, just say the last name Esslinger and that should buy you something. They have been there so long, there are those who still remember them. Name dropping is good in circumstances like that. Are we living in such a way that if someone dropped our name, it would produce smiles, help, or would it be, oh, never mind? And the same question I would ask about our Christianity. Are we living in such a way that there can be a correlation between our name, whether it's Christian or whether it's our last name, and good character? And hopefully we are doing such a thing. We can reference Isaiah 56, verse 5. I think I'll bypass turning there, but please put it in your notes and refer to it later on. That's your homework. Am I allowed to assign homework, Mr. Dowd? Okay. Isaiah 56, verse 5. How does this apply? Let's continue on to Matthew 25. If you turn with me, please, to Gospel of Matthew again, this time chapter 25. Here we will read verses 14 through 21. Matthew 25, verse 14, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a man traveling to a far country, who called his own servants and delivered his goods to them." This was a very trusting act. It wasn't really an inheritance, but a very trusting act to deliver all his goods. To one, he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1. And how did this get parsed? Well, to each according to his own ability. And immediately he went on a journey. And he who had received 5 talents went and traded with them and made another 5 talents. And likewise, he who had received 2 gained 2 more also, which is remarkable that both of them doubled. And yet the one who still got back 5 had more risk associated. They both doubled. 1 made 5, 1 made 2. Verse 18, "But he who had received 1 went and dug in the ground and hid his Lord's money. And after a long time, the Lord of those servants came and settled accounts with them." That's an important element, the long time. This individual who buried that talent had a long time to consider that action, a long time to reconsider that action, but didn't. Verse 20, "He who had received 5 talents came and brought 5 other talents, saying, 'Lord, you delivered me 5, and look, I've gained 5 more talents beside them.' His Lord said, 'Well done, good and faithful servant, you were faithful over a few things, 5 things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord.'" There are many things that we could discuss about this passage. In this passage, we've read many times and heard it discussed many times. One element that I'd like for us to consider is that God has a measured approach in giving us stuff, in rewarding us. He doesn't want us to have too much too soon. Is it possible to have too much too soon? Well, it's the time of year where serious gardeners will be not just looking at seed catalogs, but may be starting to sprout seeds. They may be starting to actually start growing them. Some like to start from seed, some get seedlings. Depending on who we are, we may be engaged in that process ourselves. Yet at some point, I'm not sure when the sweet spot is in this part of Wisconsin. I know back home we wait until after Mother's Day before trying to put anything in the ground. We do have a grow light at home. It's keeping alive a few plants. But even when my wife, when she hatches her tomato plants and they start to grow and it's warm enough to start planting them, they go outside for a little bit, for an hour. Then they come back inside. And then the next day, if it's still sunny, they go back outside for 2 hours and then they come back inside. We learn the hard way that tomato plants can get sunburnt if they're not used to sunlight. If they were sprouted indoors and they are used to a grow light, you can't just put them outside and leave them. They'll shrivel up and die. That sun is too intense for them. They're not used to it. Even though they crave sunlight, they want sunlight. You can't give them too much sunlight too soon. They're not ready for it. God recognizes our frailties and recognizes that good things need to be given to us a little at a time. Too much too soon is not good. We similarly need that, for lack of a better term, being sun-hardened. So God has our long-term in mind and wants us to succeed. We start small. God gives us small responsibilities and sees the progress we make. Or if we're back home, he may wait and see what progress we make. We make progress in Canada, not progress. And see if we can then move on to bigger responsibilities. And that's part of what we see going on here in Matthew 25. There are many other things for sure, but he gives us a little at a time. Let's look at 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3. Let's start reading in verse 10. Second Timothy 3, verse 10. Where Paul wrote to Timothy, "But you have carefully followed my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, love, perseverance, persecutions, afflictions, which happened to me at Antioch, at Iconium, at Lystra. What persecutions I endured." And this is quite a list. If we go back to verse 10, doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, love, perseverance, persecutions, afflictions. There's nine elements here. So you want to be a good follower of the Apostle Paul who's following Jesus Christ, then all we have to do are these nine things: doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, love, perseverance, persecution. Easy. Check, 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 check. Do we have them all checked off? How are we doing? How am I doing with these things? Well, like previously, a little bit at a time. A little better each day, a little better each year. Paul continues as he acknowledges the persecutions he endured that the Lord delivered him. Verse 12, "Yes, and all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution." Well, isn't that good news? On the bright side, we're all in this together, dealing with persecutions, with these trials, with these tests. Verse 13, a very sobering thing to consider. But evil men and imposters, and one's bad enough, evil men. Well, they're easy to see, aren't they? Easy to spot. Easy people, they don't hide themselves. That's not so bad. But imposters? Well, that's more tricky. They're evil men who are not so brash or bold. They're hiding themselves. Evil men and imposters will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived, but you must continue in the things which you have learned and been assured of, knowing from whom you have learned them. Continuing in. This is a beautiful description of, well, so many that we would meet in any congregation and any of the churches of God. Individuals who have continued in this way year after year, decade after decade, and continue to be faithful, continuing doing these things that they have learned and been assured of. I can remember, let's just say, the mid-90s, when there were disruptions in the church we were going to, connecting with my grandparents and hearing them talk about it, and Grandpa saying, no, I can't do the things that they're telling me to do there because that's what we used to do. Been there, done that. I'm going to continue doing what we were taught. Continue in this way and follow these teachings. There is a marketing adage that one of the best ways of selling something to somebody they don't really need is to convince them that this other product is new. It's improved, far superior than what you have. What you have is old, it's junk, it's garbage. You don't need that. You deserve better. You deserve more. You deserve new. And how something can be both new and improved is not logical. How can it be improved if it's new? Or how can you improve on something new? But that's the way it goes. Can we think back on when we learned the truth? For some of us, maybe it was a radio program. For others of us, it was a TV program. For others, a magazine. Maybe others, it was something seen on the internet. Regardless of the medium that was used, regardless of the face, who it actually was, we know without doubt that it was God that was behind. God who was behind the truth that was spoken. And His Spirit that allowed us to recognize truth and allowed it to resonate in us. That it was God who showed us truth, and God who showed us the right way. Always God gives the option of whether or not an individual will serve Him, but doesn't provide options or wiggle room for how we serve Him. Let's stay in Paul's instruction to Timothy, turning back to 1 Timothy chapter 4, just a few pages back. First Timothy chapter 4, starting in verse 12. Let no one despise your youth, though the youth is wasted on the young. It never made sense to me until I started getting sore, and until I started making funny sounds when I stooped over to pick something up, until I started seeing platinum hair coming in. I'm determined never to have gray hair, only platinum hair. And starting to come in, the platinum. Let no one despise your youth, but be an example to the believers in war. And here, another remarkable list. All you have to do to get people's appropriate respect. Be an example to believers in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity. It's an easy list, right? When we start digging into what this list implies and means, this is a big ask. It's a tremendous responsibility. Till I come, verse 13, give attention to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. It's important for us to give attention to reading the book, to spend time in it every day. The rule of thumb used to be, still is, half-hour personal Bible study every day. Read it. Give attention to reading. Give attention to exhortation, to doctrine, the teaching that has been delivered. And as we read in the previous passage, the doctrine that was taught to us, the teaching that was shown to us. Do not neglect the gift that is in you, which was given to you by prophecy, with the laying on of the hands of the eldership. Meditate on these things. Again, another rule of thumb is to have daily dedicated prayer time, Bible study time, meditation time every day, to spend time doing these things, these spiritual disciplines that are so beneficial for us to grow, in addition to not daily fasting, but regular fasting. One is more economical, but not terribly doable in the long run, which is why we do it intermittently. Meditate on these things and give yourself entirely to them. I like that phraseology. Do we give ourselves to these things, or do we feel guilted into them? Yes, I have to. I'll read the scripture. If I have to, I'll pray. No, give yourself entirely to them, that your progress may be evident to all. Take heed to yourself and to the doctrine. Continue in them, for in doing this you will save both yourself and those who hear you. And take heed to the doctrine, giving attention to doctrine. What we have been gifted, what we have inherited, is truth. We've inherited truth. We understand why we're here today instead of tomorrow. Why it is that we observe holy days and not other days. And so many other doctrines that we have received that have been proven and tested over time, they've been gifted to us. They were gifted to you, they were gifted to me, and they're like an inheritance. What condition are they in? How will we use these teachings, these doctrines? Are we going to drill holes in them so it's convenient to place them on a pegboard? No. I hope not. There are individuals who will take a beat-up old square like this and have pointers to restore it. And I've shown this to a good friend of mine here who looked at it and said, yeah, sorry, those etchings are long gone. There's not a good way to bring back those numbers, but I know there are ways of making the brass shiny again. I know there are ways that I could hide this drilled hole, which, convenient though it may be, is not conducive to long-term survivability of rosewood. There are ways that we can treat items we inherit that allow them to last longer and allow them to be passed on to other generations so they too can derive the benefit of what was intended. How about our doctrines? How about our teachings? My personal objective has always been to look at the church, to look at teachings as, oh, I don't know, maybe another inheritable good, maybe a beautiful silver serving tray. I've always envisioned trying to treat it in such a way that, yes, it gets used for its intended purpose, but when I pass it on, I don't want there to be dents and dings and scratches. In fact, I want to wear gloves so that when I pass it on, not even my fingerprints are on it. It's not been marred. It's not been inappropriately personalized. It's passed on in immaculate condition. We've received the truth once upon a time. Maybe recently, maybe a long time ago, maybe several generations ago, it was introduced into our families. We have a responsibility to take care of it, to use the truth as God intended that truth be used, and to preserve it the way he intended it to be preserved, so that when we pass it on, it was in a condition like we received it. And once upon a time in the future, if I can use that anachronism, we can meet those who have gone before us. We can speak to the Apostle Paul. We can speak to Polycrates. We can speak to whoever in the history of the Church of God. And we can talk to them and discuss the teachings that we had, the teachings that we taught our next generations to pass on. And they say, yeah, that's exactly what we taught and what we passed on. What a tragedy it would be to have to explain how this message got changed if we are careless. Like the telephone game. Remember playing that as a kid? One person whispers a phrase into the ear of somebody else, and they whisper it to the person beside them, and so on and so on. And by the end, they have to tell what the message was, and how often is it the same? Well, never, because that's the fun, right? Is the teaching, there's a doctrine that we have, that we are passing on, does it resemble what we received? And will it resemble, at the end of time, what was passed on originally? How important it is for us to take great care. Take heed, we see in verse 16. Take heed to yourself and to the doctrine. There's a lot that God is learning of us. He sees how we manage our family name. He sees how we manage the resources that he's given to us, recognizing that time and chance do fall upon any of us and all of us in a variety of ways. How do we manage these things? How do we manage the Christian name, the badge that he allows us to wear? How do we manage that? How do we manage the truth? How do we manage the doctrine that we have been given, that we've inherited? That is our responsibility then to pass on. And while living this way does at times have inherent sacrifices, there are ways and times that we do miss out. And he notices our lack. He notices what we've lost and keeps track. And I'm sure is calculating some formula of interest for anything that we have lost and will reward us accordingly. And indeed, as Christians, we have a responsibility to provide for our families. As collectively, as Christians, as a church, we similarly have an obligation to preserve each other's good name as Christians. But how more important is it for a church to make sure that the doctrine, the teaching that we have inherited, that we are teaching it in such a way that it will be passed on in appropriate condition to be inherited for generations to come.